the physics course, and by the way, I was a little, I wasn't well advised in that. I should have had the math the first year. So I was taking differential equations in physics at the same time, whereas it would have been a lot better had I had the differential equations behind me. But that meant, let's see, we had 9 hours of freshman chemistry laboratory. We had 8 hours of physics laboratory. And one afternoon, I don't know how this worked out, but one afternoon in geology laboratory. So it was a pretty husky schedule. I had a man named Cartledge, G.H. Cartledge, as a that gave freshman chemistry 4 lectures and 9 hours of lab. And I would guess that all the chemistry I knew by the time I got a PhD, I got that first year, or all, you know, the perimeter was certainly marked out.
Do you remember what text was used?
I actually have it, but not here. Let's see. I remember it's a lot smaller than the current text, I'll tell you. And had every week we did, you know, how they used to do it by column on the periodic table. I'll see if I can find it, but I don't remember it now. It was predominantly. Reading the text was fairly simple and straightforward, no great problems. I got a great deal out of Cartledge's lectures. He prepared them carefully, and you know, they were sort of fully developed. I always, when I knew him in that class, I always thought of him as a dour individual. I got to know him much better when he was at Oak Ridge later, and I was in Texas. In fact, we worked together on some problems. But he was very straightforward and very clear, and he generally clarified the questions I had out of the text without being asked. So he saw the same questions the class did, I guess. It was a class of about, I'd say, 100, all pretty good students. So there's no, you know, the distribution wasn't like that. The distribution's more like this. And he knew that. He'd been there for a long time. And that meant that he produced his words at a level that got us all interested at the same time. It was fast-moving, thorough, and you could be reasonably sure he was right. In the light of the day, of that day, in what he said. So it moved very rapidly. And I got to tell you, 4 classes versus current 3 and 9 hours of lab versus current 3 makes a big difference. So that you were prepared almost at the end of that year to be a chemist.
Were there many chem majors in your group?
No. I would make a guess that there were, in that 100, at maximum 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. Most of them were pre-meds. And, you know, a smattering of other things, like geologists and so forth, but most, 80% of them were pre-medical. The laboratories were pretty involved. The stuff that you had to work with was all right. It wasn't outstanding. The first semester was series of experiments, densities, reactions, whatnot. And the second semester was qual. That was tough. That was very tough.
Especially with 9 hours a week.
Yeah. And we had lots of unknowns, you know. Mm-hmm. We'd go through the system first, get one unknown, For the first group, I guess we got a couple that started to get used to the thing. Then we get group 2A and 2B separately. They were tough, I gotta tell you. They were not the easiest thing in the world to work out. You know, lots of H2S in the air.
Right.
Kip generators operating under the hoods, and the hoods not working particularly well. There was no compromise. You turned in your report, and the guy looked it up and either put a check or an X or something. I forget what the grades were like. And if you didn't get it right, go back and do it again. The second time, you got a grade, because you couldn't stay there forever doing 2A. And you got the feeling that you knew what you were doing. You did group 2, man, that was a tough group. Then you got group 3, which was tough because the KSPs were not nearly as well separate or as different as they were in group 2. And you finally worked your way through that. Group 4 was all right. Then you got to this dumb bunch of alkaline metals, and they were stinkers. Then of course, you'd get the full thing. No, then we did anions. But anions were no great shucks. All you did was spot testing. Mm-hmm. Then you'd get the big deal. Tell me what's in it.
Let me just ask, in view of what you've been saying, since qualitative analysis has been rapidly disappearing from the chemistry curriculum, how you feel about that in light of your experience years ago with it?
I think that the trend away from laboratories is wrong, first of all, because there's still laboratory science. If it involves the use of computers and the computer in the laboratory, ought to be carried out. And the qual, if you look on qual in itself as teaching you chemistry, that's not likely to happen except in a very limited fashion. If you look on qual as a means of instilling into you the need for careful work and thoughtful arrangement of what you're going to do, then I think it's very important. Mm-hmm. Certainly for the guy who's going to be a chemist or a chemical engineer. And it probably is of value to the other people, too, in the sense of organizing what you're doing. I mean, just learning how to do things. One could say that quantitative analysis is more of a disciplined activity, but I didn't see it that way. I thought the other was quantitative analysis. By that time, you're sort of semi-pro at least. And I never felt that was a great shucks in molding the chemical activity. The qual was pretty important, I thought. Now, they really ought to go back to it, because we can do it without Kip generators now. In fact, what they ought to really do is have students devise their own schemes based on some kind of program that you can stick in a computer and say, here are the things we want to look for, and here are the characteristics of those things. Devise a scheme. I think that could be done. And that would be a nice creative kind of thing. But the tendency to low rate the lab and get rid of it, I think is wrong. Even for the non-major. We'll come to that when I talk sometime later about science policy. But
yes, I just wanted to throw that part about qual in, since we were talking about it. Were you discouraged at all by this extensive involvement at that point, or were you encouraged to continue as a chemistry major?
Well, I was never discouraged, but two things. And this is the way it should be in college. My first taste of the geological sciences, my first real taste of philosophy, and my first insight into psychology. And these were fields that I had no knowledge about before. And I really got very interested in all of them. I took 3 years of philosophy, all with Boas and his assistants. Part of one of those years was a course in logic, which I've always thought was not only interesting but useful. I took a couple of years of psychology because back in the late 20s, early 30s, that was a mumbo-jumbo area. Freud was known as a name, but I had a guy named Dunlop who was a very highly thought of psychologist, I find later. In fact, his name still appears, you know, 60 years later. He was not a very inspiring lecturer, but for some reason, what he said attracted me. And I still have a kind of peripheral interest. I serve on an advisory committee for the Center for Behavioral Science, up the hill from Stanford. And I've always had an interest in that. I've always had an interest in geology. I've always had an interest in philosophy. But when the chip was down, roughly in my junior year, I stayed in chemistry. Just possibly because where did you get a job in these other three things? It wasn't too clear where you get a job in chemistry, but it was better than the others. So the answer is that I was never discouraged about chemistry, but I suddenly saw other things that interested me. I never really got an interest in engineering per se, never got an interest in medical school. You know, that could have happened. With all my friends around me rushing off to medical school, I might have just been aspirated into the same direction. But I took organic chemistry with Emmett Reed.
Oh yes,
Reed's famous name at the time.
Yes,
terrible lecture. mumbled, talked to the board. It was just hard as hell to understand what he was saying. And we used his book. And organic never really impressed me because, you know, at that time it was, you knew the name reactions and you did those things. But I then had a course from F.O. Rice. And I would say that Rice was certainly a prototypical physical organic chemist. I literally took undergraduate organic from Rice. And that was quite different. I was thinking about that last night when he gave his prize at Daring and Roberts. Rice obviously, you know, preceded both of those guys and was not in as good a position to be recognized. But he was a free radical man when free radicals were just Gomberg's free radical, the trimethyl methane. And he delved into photo processes. And he looked at energy flows and things. That's a very peculiar for 1930s organic chemist. So I got a different insight, but not enough to want to go into the field. And never took a literal course in physical chemistry. Had a laboratory and a lot of separated courses, like X-rays and whatnot, but never an actual physical chemistry course. And I cannot tell you, but I believe that my intention had always been from the time I was taking these high school courses to be a physical chemist. Inorganic, by the way, is not much of a thing. You did chromates and you did so forth, but there was no real coherent field. You either were an organic chemist or a non-organic. And I decided to go into physical.
What was it that attracted you to that area?
Well, I was reasonable in mathematics, not great. That probably kept me from being a physicist. I never thought about being a physicist, but if I wanted to be, I'd have to have been a little more facile with math. I was interested in materials more than forces, but I was interested in the characteristics of the materials rather than the production of the material. So that sort of points you in that direction. Actually, I had a very early interest in colloids and surface chemistry, which is peculiar because colloids is really on its way out. And so I didn't recognize it in the 30s. See, as a senior at Hopkins, and because I had this new plan arrangement, I didn't take a formal physical chemistry course, but I did take as a senior lots of graduate courses. And I had Joe Mayer teaching quantum mechanics and statistical mechanics. Now this was 1932. Joe Mayer had just come back from Göttingen, where he had either been postdocing or instructing or something like that. Young guy, but recognizable as a real comer. And his wife, who ultimately got a Nobel Prize 20 years later. As in the forefront of a different kind of chemistry, Pauling had already written his book, his freshman book, in the early 30s at least, and had approached chemistry quite different. Smith, I had Alexander Smith as freshman.
Oh, text. Sure, sure.
Okay. Alexander Smith.
Yes.
And the Pauling book I saw some years later, maybe, of course, I was a teaching, they didn't call them teaching assistants, and I forget what they call them. I don't remember, but it was teaching assistants. But as a senior, I had Mayer in quantum and statistical mechanics. No textbook. We had mimeographed notes, which I still have someplace. Hard to read, but I got them. And I took X-ray crystallography, the name a lot. And the laboratory, which were a series of experiments that you did yourself. That is, they weren't textbook experiments, but you catalytic decomposition of ammonia, for example, on platinum surface, that kind of thing. Where you got experience doing vacuum work, where you got experience with catalysts, where you got experience with following rates, determining orders of reaction. So the sort of last formal undergraduate course I had was the organic course that I took from Rice. And looking back, there are actually two undergraduate courses, all I had at college, freshman and organic. Never took an analytical course. Never took a formal physical. Hopkins is a very good place to be at the time. I mean, you worked your way through yourself through the educational process, and then you demonstrated that you knew something, as much as they wanted you to know. But as I said, in order to be formally correct, I did plunk down the $10 for a BA diploma in 1932. But I'd already done basically all the coursework for the PhD. And I started working in the laboratory with W.A. Patrick. Patrick was the guy who had the silica gel patents, which I think he handed off to Baltimore Chemical Company. If Grace owns them now, but I forget. Davidson Chemical Company. And Davidson made silica gel for many years. They were the main purveyors of it. But I started the work in Patrick's lab in my first year, right in my transition from getting the bachelor's degree, and took only a few formal courses, just sort of now and then, nothing too formal. Of course, with Noyes and Sherrill. You remember Noyes and Sherrill? A course in thermodynamics from Donald Andrews. I had an organic course with Reed, which is where I learned that I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. Couldn't understand Noyes. That's all, I guess. From that point on, it was all laboratory work. At Hopkins, at that time, what you did was go around to pick four laboratories and work in them for a couple of months each in the first year. And it was on the basis of that that you decided where you wanted to be your PhD.
What were the others? I was going to ask you how you selected Patrick. What were the other laboratories that you spent some time
in? Well, I went into the crystallographic laboratory, the X-ray laboratory. I went into Reed's laboratory. I went into the laboratory of a guy named Fraser, who was a catalyst chemist. And I went into Patrick's. In Reed's laboratory, I did... He was writing a book on sulfur chemistry. And I prepared a lot of thioethers and...
Really?
Man, I stunk. I got to tell you, I could get on a streetcar and get a seat with no trouble. I did that for several months. The one lab accident I had was in Reed's lab. I was doing a grignard, and I can't remember why I was doing it. But I was adding formaldehyde to grignard reagent. And this was early enough in the game that we used soft glass. And I remember the formaldehyde, the paraformaldehyde was in a three-neck flask. And I came out of one of the necks with a U-tube. It wasn't actually a U-tube. It was two pieces of tubing with holes blown in and a cross piece fused into those holes. And these are soft glass so that, you know, that it was tenuous. And the horizontal piece was wrapped with nichrome just out in the open. There was best nothing on it with battery clips holding it to the wires that came out of the plug. I guess it had a rheostat so you could adjust. Anyway, I had the paraformaldehyde being heated, and we weren't heating over electric systems, we were heating over gas. And I had corks in the tops of these two vertical tubes, rubber stoppers, not corks. And the damn thing had plugged, you know. It had sublimed and got caught in the middle someplace. And nothing was happening in the grignard where the store was. And I went to look over the top to see where the plug was. And the thing blew out. And I caught this formaldehyde up my nose. I mean, it was a heavy dose. I had a devil of a time catching my breath. I hung out the window about an hour. But I had it selectively damaged my odor sensors. For example, I can't detect house gas. I can't smell skunks. But some things, certain perfumes, are accentuated. I sometimes get in the cab with the cab driver, it's got a little bit of something on, I gotta get out. So, but I'm fortunate, that was the extent of my accident in life. It also decided me against being an organic chemist. I think that was a straw. At any rate, I did that lab, I did the x-ray lab. That wasn't bad. Back then, the x-ray labs, you know what you did, you packed that collodion tube with powder and put it down in the middle of this circular camera. And we actually had an ion tube rather than an electron tube. And you had to stopcock that you had to crack properly in order to maintain a proper vacuum. And you also had to center this camera on the exit tube, x-ray tube. And you do that by reaching around a ledge shield that's out there. And you sort of fiddle with it, get it lined up. You had a zinc sulfide, you had a phosphor sitting back here. You look to get it straight. Well, these two fingers began to, just the ends of these two fingers began to show burns. You know, you're in that x-ray scatter all the time. People didn't worry about it for a while. But they began to show burns. And I decided I wasn't going to do that one. So I got rid of two of them. And the